Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Rob Wolf, and welcome to New Books in Science Fiction. This is the Unhappy in Its Own Way edition. Literature is full of families torn apart by tragedy, death, war, crime. But what if the members of a family can't agree on the cause of the tragedy that divides them? In Mike Chen's new novel, Light Years from Home, sisters Cassie and Evie agree that their brother Jacob vanished 15 years ago. But did he run away so he could party to his heart's content, as Cassie believes? Or was he abducted by aliens, as Evie thinks? Their starkly different interpretations of the facts exacerbates the pain and tragedy of their brother's disappearance, pushing the family to the point of breaking. Mike Chen is the author of Here and Now and Then, A Beginning at the End, We Could Be Heroes, and the forthcoming Star Wars Brotherhood. This is his third time on the podcast, and he is with me now from his home in the Bay Area. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Tell me how you've been. I mean, you've been like all of us. Life has been different the last couple of years. So how are you? And is this book going to be different? I know you had a book come out during the pandemic, and now, I don't know, we don't know if we're at the end of it, but are you planning live events? What's the deal?
I do have a live event planned at the end of February, but it's an outdoor signing with my local indie bookstore. So everything is kind of being planned with one foot in, is it going to change? And in commitments are, they're really, I actually just got asked to be in a conference out of state. So I've committed to San Francisco Writers Conference in July, because July seems reasonable and it's local, so I don't have to worry about travel. I got asked to be in an out-of-state conference in August, and I haven't turned it down yet, but like I talked about it with my wife, and we're like, God, they need to know in like 2 weeks, and she's like, you know, there's so many logistics with traveling out of state, including looking at their, you know, relative safety protocols and community, and it's a weird year. I figured, I mean, this is going off on a tangent, but I remember when the pandemic, when we were in the thick of it in like middle of 2020, there was one epidemiologist that said like these things typically have like a 3-year cycle before you can start to embrace coming back to normal again. And like, I can see that now, like the first year is kind of like, what the hell is happening? Then you have last year, which is like the, like where therapeutics and vaccinations start to take hold. This year is kind of like a transitionary year where like we're trying to integrate all the lessons that we've learned. So anyway, that's my spiel on the pandemic. But yeah, like as an author, I'm getting invited to some live events. I have had live events, tentative plans for them for January and February, basically just get moved out a few months or canceled. And in the Bay Area, Charlie Jane Anders is a good friend. And she has been trying to restart her Writers with Drinks program here. And they had, I think, 2 months where they did it. I think it was November and December. And then they canceled for January and February. And they just announced that they're back in March with, you know, all sorts of safety precautions. So it's a transitionary year. I feel like everything's two steps forward, two steps back. or one step back. That math works better.
A little, yeah. It's sort of like, who knows what the next step will be. I guess that's kind of what it feels like a little bit. Well, let's dive in. Let's talk about Light Years from Home. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can start with the Shao family.
Yes.
They've gone through hell after Jacob has disappeared. I mean, this was the book starts 15 years after his disappearance on a camping trip. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Shao family and tell us about Cassie and Evie and their mom.
So the Shao family, one of the things that I really wanted to show with this book was how a single moment can really change the trajectory of people's lives. And so 15 years ago, they're on this camping trip. They're college-aged, you know, young adults. Cassie is like kind of middling in college. Evie's the younger sister who's like been the more studious one. Jacob is the complete disaster that just kind of lies and cheats his way through everything. And they're on this camping trip and like the dad's trying to talk Jacob from like, you know, making really bad choices. And they both disappear. And then a few days later, their dad returns, Jacob is gone. And their dad is talking about like, I swear we were on a spaceship, there were aliens, there were all these things going on. And so that fundamentally changes the direction of this family. So Cass has this attitude of like, if no one else is going to fix it, I am going to fix it. And Evie kind of has the same thing, except she thinks about it as, I'm going to fix it by going with my dad on like these UFO hunts, and we're going to find my brother. And their mom wants to just move forward because that's the only way that she knows how to do it. And so you see these trajectories of where this family, where each member was originally heading, and then they've gone in like a completely other angle because this disaster has happened to them and none of them know the truth. None of them know how to process it. So the story picks up in the present time when Jacob returns and they're not quite sure what to make of this.
All families confronting a tragedy have their challenges. And it seems to me one thing you're conveying is that the Shao family has trouble talking about their feelings. And so there's a lot bottled up.
There's that, but it's also because they can't agree on what happened. And I think that creates the biggest rift there. One of the biggest inspirations for this book was the Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House. Like when I watched that, I thought, I wish I wrote that. And even it's different from the Shirley Jackson novel. It's thematically the same, and it's got a lot of the same character names. But the series itself is really profound and beautiful character examination of what happens when a family fractures. Like, what happened then, what happens now. And I was really, I get inspired by the media that I'm watching or reading at the time. And I saw that and I thought, I really wish I wrote that. So I combined that with a short story that I have been needling around with that never went anywhere. And like the tone of X-Files, and that's where this came from.
I don't think it's too much of a spoiler because really right at the beginning, you know, you're telling the story through the perspective of the three siblings. So we get into Jacob's head pretty early in the book.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, even though Cassie and Evie disagree about what happened, the reader gets to learn, assuming Jacob is a reliable narrator, his version.
Right.
So what's his version?
Well, it was really important to ground the story in Jacob's point of view and then show Evie and Cassie in their points of view deconstructing it. And each has a very plausible explanation of what they're interpreting. So with Jacob's point of view, the story opens with Jacob's experience of being on a spaceship in the middle of this intergalactic war, and he's escaping from and he's escaping with vital intel on how he can win the war. And so that's the only space opera scene like really in there. I joke that the book is 90% family drama, 10% space opera, but the space opera is what drives all of the family drama. From what I can glean from like the people who did not like the book, it's because they wanted more space opera, and that's more power to you. I did not write that. I did not intend to write that, so it's totally okay. But so the space opera is put at the front because I felt otherwise it would feel very abstract. You know, you would have the two sisters talking about, like, I think it's this. No, I think it's this. You would have Jacob, in Jacob's perspective, hunting for this object that is kind of like the goal of his mission. But without that one scene of this is him on this ship, these things are happening, there's explosions, power is failing, all this stuff. Without that, it wouldn't feel very real. So I thought it was very important that we experience things through Jacob's eyes. And then as you see the sisters interpreting it, then you start to decide, like, who is the unreliable perspective here?
Why is Jacob so engaged and invested in this life in space that he is recounting? Because the family's broken when he leaves, mm-hmm. and he's very committed to, you know, what initially is, according to him, he was just lifted up and was among strangers then, you know, from Earth into this new world. And he's very committed to it, even though he must know he's left behind loved ones who don't really have a explanation for what happened.
This is something that I often think about with science fiction, because the stories of space opera or intergalactic conflict or whatever, when you have like someone who is plucked out of their menial existence and swept off into, you know, a much bigger conflict, it is riffing off of that. But from a real personality perspective, you see that Jacob, he's just kind of a screw up. He's like a high school athlete that got by on his charm and his, you know, his athletic ability and cheating off of his sister. You know, so he doesn't have a lot of direction. And for someone like that, I think like a real world analog is like, you know, if someone doesn't have a lot of direction and then like, you know, they wind up going on a Peace Corps or something like that, where their complete worldview changes. And they find something to commit to because they finally understand that the world is bigger than what they care about. And in this case, this is Jacob seeing a galaxy at war. And I think about, like, you know, even from like the 80s, something like The Last Starfighter or something like that, where, you know, someone is plucked from Earth and put into something sort of like larger conflict. Would that make your concerns on Earth just disappear? And I would think, for some people, they would be like, I miss my family too much. But other people would be like, holy crap, there is so much more out here and I have a chance to make a difference. And that's really what Jacob's perspective is.
Their mother is an interesting character. One thing she says to them at various times is, how are you going to fix it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's sort of a phrase she has. And it's interesting to note, as my cat starts wheezing. Are you okay? He's sitting on my lap.
We can pause for a second.
Are you going to make noise? He sometimes gets like, it's almost like asthmatic. But
we
have
four cats, so I totally understand like the sudden like wheezing or barfing.
Yeah, right. Well, no barfing, please. Not here. Are you going to go? Why don't you leave and you can go somewhere else? There you go. Okay. So she says, how are you going to fix it? And one thing that's very interesting is that the siblings, although they all are very different and divided in some ways at various points in the book, they actually share, it seems to me, they've absorbed that advice. How are you going to fix it? They are all determined to fix something in their lives, and they share this kind of similar determination and single-minded focus. I mean, they're very disciplined. It's just that when they're opposed to each other, as the sisters are, then they're disciplined, then it just makes their conflict that much more intense, I think.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I also wanted to show how children of the same parents can absorb their upbringing in completely different ways, like completely different interpretations. So what you have with Cass's version of fixing it is keeping the family from breaking. Evie's version of fixing it is, I'm going to find my missing brother. And Jacob's version of fixing it is, this galaxy is at war and I'm going to help stop it. So it's the same motivation, just through completely different lenses. And I always thought that to be really interesting. I know so many sibling pairs or trios or whoever, where they are completely different. But when you see them around their parents, you see elements of them overlapping. And the other thing that I think about a lot with my own family is how when you have adult children get back together with their family, they revert to being 17 or whatever. Like the jokes and the pettiness and everything, like it all comes back. And my counselor once explained, like, I forget what the technical term is for that, but like that's very much a theme about like how you're very influenced by your surroundings. So I wanted to kind of play off of that, where like these sisters, like, they don't really talk to each other that much, and this their brother, like, they have not seen their brother, but when they are back together, all of their bad habits with each other come rushing back, but with the life experience of where they are now. And I thought that's a really fun dichotomy to play with.
So you've kind of created a niche for yourself. You write about families a lot, nuclear families, and it seems like there's a theme of families being pulled apart by some science fictional element, you know, whether it's time travel, which was Here and Now and Then, or in this case, there's an interstellar war going on. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. You like to write about family and homes.
I really like to examine relationships. And when, you know, most people say relationships, they think of like romantic relationships. But I like to think of all facets of interpersonal relationships. And I love science fiction. The home office that I am in is just littered with science fiction merchandise. So it's a huge part of me. And I've always liked examining the characters in these fantastical situations, because I think like it's so extreme and so different that a lot of stories just kind of skip over that extreme element of it. It's war, or it's space travel, or it's time travel, or things that would really mess with your head. And there's so much room to play with on a character level that, like, if you just remove the end of the galaxy, end of the world, end of time, you know, like those types of stakes, if you take those away and you examine what's really happening on a character level, there's a lot of interesting stuff to play with, because it would cause so many feelings to surface, I would think, like by just being put in the most extreme of circumstances. So I keep going back to that. I think that's probably, I don't think I'm skilled enough of an action writer that I couldn't write a pure giant epic fantasy or epic space opera or whatever. And like my upcoming Star Wars book, there's lightsaber fights and there's chases and stuff like that. But it's a very character focused, like you're in Obi-Wan's head, you're in Anakin's head, and there is a clear arc about like they're trying to figure out who they are as people. So it's, I think, very much still on my, you know, so-called brand.
And your characters are usually either drawn to home, or maybe they're trying to get away from home.
Yeah. My parents have never brought that up to me when they read it. They read my books, and I don't think they've ever picked up on my interpretations that found family is typically better than blood family. So I'll leave that. But I mean, I do. You can probably tell a lot about my upbringing and my worldview by the fact that I keep going back to that. And it's not necessarily intentional. I realized, actually, when I was doing publicity for my third book, We Could Be Heroes, which is about a superhero and a supervillain who discover that they're better off as best friends rather than enemies. And you get into their past and you get into the families that they came from and they left behind. And I realized that the recurring themes in my books are how memory shapes identity and how chosen family shapes identity. So even when I try to consciously move away from that, I think I keep falling back into it. So, you know, it's just part of who I am.
Well, I remember you telling me when we first met virtually, you know, in an interview about Here and Now and Then, which was your debut. If I remember right, you were talking about how it was hard for you initially to sell the book because people didn't know how to classify the book. It wasn't science fictional enough for a science fiction publisher, and it wasn't mainstream literature enough for a mainstream publisher. But that doesn't seem to be a problem for you anymore.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, is the market has really, really shifted. I mean, so many of the authors you have on your podcast are kind of in this character-driven space. And I think like there's so much more room for it now than there was. I mean, when I was on sub is when your agent tries to sell your manuscript to a publisher. So I was on sub from 2015 to 2017. Typically, being on sub, you have like a window of about like 6 to 8 months, but we kept it open for like 2 years because we kept getting all these near misses where the creative team was really excited about it. And then the business side would be like, well, we're not quite sure how to sell that. But now, you know, there's just so much more of like this willingness to lean into character against a really science fiction or fantasy backdrop. So I think like the market has changed for that. And I credit a lot of it to actually the rise of streaming services, because there's a lot more variety in what we see. You know, we have comic TV shows like WandaVision now, which are just character examinations about trauma, or the adaptation of Station 11. You have things like that that I don't think would have existed before the streaming era, when there were so many outlets willing to experiment with tone and character and move away from formulaic stuff that we've seen so much already. So yeah, I don't think I would have the success that I did if this was like 10 years ago, but I think there's really a market and an appetite for that now.
It's almost like you have your own subgenre, though. It's like familial science fiction or something.
Yeah. I told myself when my debut came out and everyone was asking, like, will you write a sequel or another time travel novel? And I was like, I don't want to be the time travel guy. So I made a conscious choice that I want to basically hit every sci-fi subgenre that I really love. So it's wherever a good story fits in. I mean, so it's been time travel, post-apocalyptic, superhero. I'd say this one's a little bit of space opera and also a little bit of like X-Files, which I love both of those. And then my next one is going to be vampires. So I'm just trying to go through each of these before I start repeating myself.
That's great. And you've been very prolific too. So are you under contract usually? You have a deadline, or is this just the pace at which you go, or is the deadline driving you?
No, this is not the pace at which I go. I think like, especially during the pandemic. So my wife has a chronic condition. So we've been extremely cautious, which means one full year of remote kindergarten and half a year of homeschool first grade, which is a little different from it's partially remote, but partially like parent driven. It's really difficult and completely terrible. And somehow I've managed to keep writing through this. And it's strictly because I have contracts and the ideas are there. So I've actually found that during this, the creative process has not gotten any worse. It's purely a time and energy. It's a matter of like, can I squeeze it in? Because I find that writing, I mean, I'm one of those people that I would be writing like fan fiction or whatever if I wasn't getting published. I would be writing short stories and trying to sell those because it's very cathartic for me. It's very relaxing. It's nice to just kind of like play around with the worlds in my head. So I just need like the physical energy and time to do that. But yeah, so the amount of deadlines that I've been hitting is purely contractual. Like I think like at some point I should take a break.
I find the less time I have, sometimes the more productive I am.
Yeah. I think like, you know, there's probably going to be a point where when I hit a lull between, so with my Star Wars book, the offer came in last May and I was working on my vampire book. And I was like, I don't know if I can do both of these at the same time. Because Star Wars books have an extreme, extreme turnaround. But my wife, you know, she's also a big Star Wars fan, and she knew what an opportunity this was for me, especially because it's focusing on like my favorite era of Star Wars, which is like the prequel Clone Wars era. And so she just said like, we'll make it work. We'll figure something out, but you need to do this. It was really one of those things too, where like, you know, she would, even if we were having a rough time with parenting, she'd be like, okay, you need to go sit down tonight and write. And that's totally cool. You know, don't worry about it. So it's been a release. As pressure intensive as it was, like, it's definitely been a release. It's been a way of just kind of resetting my brain. I enjoy it far more than doing homeschool.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You've mentioned the Star Wars project, so why don't you talk a little bit about that? How is it different? You're working in a pre-existing universe and it's intellectual property. So how does that work? I mean, they come to you with an idea and they say, can you do this, or you suggest things?
Kind of. Yeah, it's an iterative process. They came to me with, or they came to my agent with, they said, like, this is the time period that we want. These are the characters we want to focus on. This is the thematic arc that we want to use. Please come up with a pitch for it. And if we're happy with the pitch, then, you know, we'll move forward. So I came up with a pitch really fast. I was very excited to do that. And once the basic pitch was accepted, we expanded like a 2-page pitch to, I wound up like the final version of the synopsis was, I think, about 25,000 words. And it had, to put that into scope for listeners, one of my novels is usually about 90 to 100,000 words. So it was about the quarter of a novel. And there were like full on speeches and dialogue and like descriptions and things, like basically anything that my brain would pop up with that I thought, like, I'm probably going to use this, I put it in there while I was writing it. And we iterated that, I think, 4 or 5 times over about 2 months, with the idea that, I mean, they know how to get this process done. Like, they've done so many of these books, and they were just like, the bigger and more detailed you make the synopsis, the easier it will be to write. And I found like the biggest difference with my books, the first 2 drafts are very light. They're very skeletal. And there's a lot of like discovery process in there. Like, I'm trying, like with Light Years from Home, I knew the siblings were going to be around college age. I knew that they were going to be like personality opposed to each other, but I didn't really know who they were until I've been working with them for a few months. And then their personalities really start to surface and became easy to say, like, no, Evie wouldn't say this, or yes, Cass would say this. And it was easy to evolve them, because at that point I'm like, I knew which parts of their personalities overlapped and which parts of their personalities were like opposite. So if I was turning the dial up on Cass is going to be the one who swears and smokes, then Evie is not going to do that because she subconsciously opposes her sister. You know, things like that. With Star Wars, I know the world. Like, I know so much mundane detail about that universe. I know the voices for Obi-Wan and Anakin. So it was very easy to, I mean, it's like writing fan fiction. It's writing fan fiction with corporate guidance. So it was really easy to just, I remember the first day that I sat down to write the first few chapters, and I was like, I wrote almost 6,000 words in like 2 or 3 hours. I'm like, they weren't all good. Like, I had to go back and revise them, but like, it flowed so easily compared to writing my own stuff, where it's like, I'm really just kind of like bumping around in the dark, trying to figure out who these characters are at that first pass. So that was the big difference with it. It's like, word count was actually really easy to hit. Revising was really easy to do. Plotting was all really easy to do, because it just feels like fan fiction, which is a lot of fun to do.
It's funny, though, when you say corporate, well, you didn't say corporate overlords, but, you know, I'm thinking of like the cliched image of a creative who's being told, no, you can't, you know, the law, legal department's coming down saying you can't do that. But here it's sort of like, it sounds like a very well-oiled machine. I mean, it's been around a long time.
Yeah, they know what to do. And I think they regularly schedule 4 to 5 books a year. So there is like a constant rolling editorial and like, and everything has to sync up too. And they're playing with like this internal timeline of, well, now with the High Republic, it's probably like 200 years in like their universe's history. So they have to, everything has to line up. So they have, you know, dedicated people to try to say like, you know, you can do this, you can't do this. This has to be planted for earlier. And that's the only way that like, you could practically do something like what they do. So like when I say corporate guidance, like there is no snark or maliciousness at all. It's like, it's purely like I am being contracted to create a sliver of time for the, for this universe. And I am so happy to do it because it's fun, but it's like, it's intellectual property. I am doing a job requested of me as opposed to like my original novels where I am like building everything from the ground up. It's just, it's a completely different process.
So when is the Star Wars book coming out?
Star Wars Brotherhood comes out on May 10th.
And then you also mentioned a vampire book. So what's the status there? What's going on?
I'm in the middle of revising it with the target of finishing this revision in about 3 weeks and making that hopefully very close to the final version of it. It's called Vampire Weekend, and it is scheduled for release next January, though I've heard the January, February, March window, but probably next January.
And what's the Mike Chen twist on vampires?
I was an angsty teen who read a lot of Anne Rice and listened to a lot of Depeche Mode and The Cure. So I was all about punk and indie music and goth aesthetics and everything like that. I was a very disaffected suburban Asian teen. And I feel like this book, outside of like the science fiction part of my interests, like really encapsulates a lot of who I was growing up. So Vampire Weekend is about a Chinese American vampire named Louise, who got turned in the early 70s at an Iggy Pop show. And she spends her immortality basically not resolving any of her intergenerational damage from her culture clash upbringing, but instead playing in bands and going to shows. That's what she does. And she, in the present day, encounters a long-lost relative who asks her, can she teach him, a teenage boy named Ian, can she teach him how to play guitar? And also, can she turn his dying mom into a vampire to save her? There's other stuff in there about the blood source, because I try to approach vampires like I do with my other science fiction or fantasy worlds with a real grounded approach. I wanted to make it like, if this was real, like how would it work? And so I look at vampirism as it's like a viral thing that keeps the body going. So the caloric intake is basically through blood. So like practically, how does that work? Well, it's not like you're getting a lot of calories from blood. So it's basically keeping it going, keeping your primary organs going, like brain, heart, lungs. Other things like digestive system, shut down. Sexual organs, shut down. So these people live this kind of like persistent existence without a lot of the things that bring us joy. And there's a lot of interesting stuff to play with that. And on a community level, these vampires know that like everyone has smartphones now. There's, you know, video surveillance dating back decades. You know, there's all this stuff. So secrecy is prime. So most of the vampires, they get their blood source from donors, from blood bags, from like these indirect ways that do not involve murder. And like there's highly encouraged, like do not murder humans. So there's an entire world building thread through there about how this community is built on day-to-day sustenance, which is an equity issue. So there's themes of that as well. And one of the driving plot points is that blood bag supplies are actually drying up and they don't know what to do about that. So those two things are woven together. And at its core, it's about, there are two main themes running through there about identity and what you were brought up with versus who you should be, who you want to be. And then on a greater world building perspective, there's a lot of talk about equity of data, equity of access, all in metaphorical form of bloods and vampires. And there's a lot of punk rock talk in there too. There's scenes with bands and at venues and the power of art over the crappy family that you that brought you up?
Well, you got me at the lack of joy. I mean, you took away sex and food, really. So that's rough.
Yeah, I think there's one of my favorite exchanges in the book is when Louise is talking with like one of the few people that she's revealed her true nature to. And he says, like, well, that's really kind of depressing. And she's like, you really think so? You know, but like, I mean, he has a point. And I think, like, you know, with all science fiction backdrops, it can be a metaphor for something. And in this case, the vampirism really is a metaphor for maturity, because like the people who in this lifestyle, and you see this a lot in vampire fiction, where they don't really evolve out of the era that they were turned in. You know, like there's always like one foot of them in there. And a lot of us, like, we don't really do that with our feelings, our relationships, our taste in pop culture. So there's a lot of thematic resonance with that, but it's just, it's vampires.
So what are your parents going to think of that? If there's like a...
I'm kind of bracing myself for that one. that's going to be interesting. Like, I don't know if they're going to pick up on... I've tried to practically disguise some of my more bitter viewpoints, but we'll see what happens with that.
So did you experience growing up a cultural divide between family culture and the environment were growing up in?
Yeah, I'd say I spent a lot of therapy in my 20s and 30s. I'm 43. I'd say like I spent probably a good 10 or 15 years in therapy, like unpacking that. And I think like it's really, really common for the first, I guess, like American generation or the first Western generation where the parents have immigrated. And it's one of those things where I understand why my parents raised me the way they were, but they came with the set of values that were more akin to where they came from. And that created a lot of searching, a lot of unhappiness, a lot of feeling not quite right, no matter where I was. And I can see now, after years of therapy, that so many of my decisions were based on that, were based on like a conscious decision to like, if I can't feel comfortable with my family, I'm going to find a subculture that I feel comfortable with. Vampires, indie music, science fiction. It's been, it'll be interesting to see how my parents take it.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a preview of that's, but that's next year. So people will be.
Yeah, next January.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah. So our world has to survive first.
Yeah. And what do you think the prospects of that are? I know you have a young daughter, so you're optimistic, I'm sure.
I don't know if I'm optimistic, but I mean, I was just telling my wife that, like, as hard as things are right now, like, if you think about, like, where we are now compared to where we were, like, 1 year ago compared to where we were 2 years ago, it's like we have so much more, like, scientific and medical advancements. We have so much more understanding. I have an engineering degree, so I tend to break down everything in the world, like analytically. And with a family medical condition and a young daughter who couldn't get vaccinated until December, like I've learned so much about this stupid disease that I wish I didn't know all this stuff. But like, because I know it now, like scientists know it like billion times more than me, and they've done a lot of work to this. So I really feel like a combination of quickly moving science and really smart people, that no matter what we argue about on Twitter, I think we're in a better place. And I think like the idea of a 3-year window seems to make sense for things.
Then you never know what the next pandemic or issue will be.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems is like I see a lot of the scientists I follow on Twitter are saying that like what we're learning now can be applied for the future if we just provide like the guidance and the money to do it. And I think that's probably like the biggest issue facing us right now.
Well, and it's people, you know, knowledge is one thing, but if people refuse to believe it, there's that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw Don't Look Up. You know, if people aren't going to look up when the comet's coming, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I think like when people ask me about, so my second book was A Beginning at the End. That was my post-pandemic book. And that came out in January 2020. And now people will ask me, like, what did you get right? Or like, what did you feel like you predicted right? And what do you feel like came out different? And I say, You can tell my book is science fiction because people trust scientists and there's competent government response in my book, which our last few years show a lot of bad shit everywhere.
Yeah. Well, let's end on a positive note. It's very exciting. You have a new book out and you have another one coming out soon and another one coming out. Another and another. That's your next title. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. This has been really fun.
Of course. I would love to come back and talk vampires in a year.
Okay. We have a date. That'll be excellent.
Sounds good.
I've been talking to Mike Chen about Light Years from Home, which came out in January from Mira Books. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the show if you don't already. And please consider leaving a review or maybe even 5 stars if you're feeling generous. Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com composed our theme music. I'm Rob Wolf, and I edit the show. Marshall Poe is editor and founder of the New Books Network, and Leanne Wilson is the co-editor. And I hope everyone's year is going smoothly so far. And don't forget to buy a few books. Thanks.